All right, we begin. The topic of tonight, or this week's Adult Parsha, is Achrimos and Kedoshim. And the topic is sexuality in the age of Tinder. Okay, so I wanted to start off with some basics. I'm going to assume people know nothing. And then we'll build from there.
About sexuality or Tinder?
I'm going to go with Tinder, sexuality. I'm going to leave that to your parents to teach you about the birds and the bees. Or whoever does that. Whoever on your staff that takes care of that. Anyways, so Tinder, so as you know, Tinder is sort of the next evolution. It's been around for, I guess, 5 years already, of online dating. So, which was a great innovation because, initially you just knew the people that you knew and you couldn't go out, and it's a big world. There are a lot of people out there. So in concept, it's good. And obviously I know, like many people that got married successfully because of online dating. So the beautiful thing about the appeal of Tinder, which we're going to go with some of the shocking statistics, is the fact is that they give you 6 pictures. Very little, you don't have to fret about deep, biographical information and, all the other things, a little more administratively annoying. Here it's very simple. You see a picture, you like it, you swipe right. You don't like it, you swipe left. And if the other person doesn't feel the same way, a shidduch. But that's not the real story here. The real story is that invariably, and again, it's hard to know precisely, hard statistics, these are not the Tinder, and I think Bumble, and Fish in the Sea, and other similar kind of variety of things. Hey, Eric. These different apps, they're not designed for people to generate long-term monogamous relationships. These are referred to facilitate a hookup. So could somebody, to the best of your understanding, translate in 2017 what a hookup refers to?
An impromptu casual sexual arrangement.
Square goes to Mendel. For 500 points in the square, correct. All right, that is what it is. So here's the, the question is how prevalent. So here are the facts. I'm going to share the screen here. Tinder has 50 million users. I think it's, it could be more. 10 million active users. 10 billion matches. 26 million matches per day. This was a statistic I found shocking. 54% of Tinder users are single. So that really was like, ouch. And to no surprise, 79% of the users are millennials. That's people in your age group.
So almost half the people are married. That's kind of sick.
Right. Now, all right, so
I don't know if it means that they're married. It could mean people that are not in exclusive relationships.
Okay, look. So I'm going to, by the way, if you're, put yourself on mute if you've got some, not talking.
Okay.
I'm hearing myself feedback. All right. So, okay. I hope Danielle is correct.
So they're cheating in a relationship that isn't married. Okay, that's much better.
Okay, I don't know exactly how to interpret that stat, and I don't know how, whatever. But that's really.
I know how to interpret that stat.
Go ahead, Samantha. Interpret that stat.
Okay, interpreting that stat, it's kind of just like you're always looking for the next best thing.
Well, obviously that's. But why they know? Only 50 were shot by, we would expect it to be 99% single. Why is it only 54% single?
Because, Rabbi, there are many terms. It's called breadcrumbing, benching, soft boying. I'll give you some definitions.
Go ahead.
A new term just came out like 2 weeks ago. I can't remember what it's called. But, you know, like you lead other people on because people are not comfortable being alone. And then when you find something better, you just, you know.
Ghost on them.
Ghost.
That's another one. Yeah. I unfortunately have heard many of these. Okay. So with that introduction, which maybe nobody needed, but I'm assuming the very best of each and every one of you. Here's a little video, and we're going to we'll start our conversation based upon the video. Here we go. Okay, I'm going to share a screen. Share a screen, go to the video. Here we go.
Right now for something a little bit different here in America's Newsroom. I recently read an editorial in a college newspaper about something called the hookup culture. In it, a female student said that the routine of drinking and having sex and then pretending you don't know each other the next day was getting her down. She thought it would be nice if you could actually at least acknowledge each other on campus after one of these hookup episodes. So I asked myself, what is really going on out there, and what is this doing to our society in the long run? So we went back to school to find out.
Most of my female friends, I have hooked up with or tried to.
You hear students talking about it on college campuses across America.
Grandma still uses hookup. But I don't think she means it the way we mean it.
So what does it mean?
Hooking up means having sex.
I think something in between kissing and sex, yeah.
The definition varies, but one thing is certain. The hookup has no strings attached.
Next morning you wake up to see what she looks like, and then maybe she gets her number.
Forget dates. Hooking up is the date.
It was like maybe you guys could have gotten lunch, but you guys hooked up.
Getting to know each other by getting it on.
People in parties just meeting up, dancing, and then you see them hooking up 2 seconds later.
Oh, man, you made up with that girl on the dance floor just now. Oh.
Going all the way can turn into going out, but students say that's rare.
It's kind of hard to have a relationship in college because everyone is about this hookup culture.
College professor Donna Freitas spent the past 8 years investigating the hookup culture. In her new book, The End of Sex, she says all this hooking up is actually desensitizing young people to the joys of romance.
You have to somehow shut down emotionally in order to hook up.
Freitas surveyed more than 1,000 college students across America and found 41% who reported hooking up used words like regretful, empty, and ashamed to describe their experience. 36% said they don't feel casual about sex, but believe everyone else around them does.
Students see the hookup as their only option, the only path toward, you know, getting together with someone that they're interested in.
NYU student Elizabeth Preza disagrees.
I do not feel pressure to hook up.
Elizabeth wrote an op-ed for her college paper objecting to Freitas' book and even the term hookup culture.
I just think that that's a completely unfair way to look at an entire generation. I think that people have a bigger window into it because, you know, we have all of this new media. We have a lot of ways that you can look in on kind of what millennial culture is doing.
Freitas says new media makes documenting your life online a social goal. She says all this detachment means that the fantasy life of co-eds is now much more tame.
All of these students would tell me, romance is talking, it's talking for hours, it's talking on a football field, on a picnic blanket with stars in the sky or candles everywhere.
Elizabeth agrees, not having sex is what's romantic.
I'd like to go backpacking.
You know what they say, for the most part, boys will be boys.
Last time, last weekend.
But there are some traditionalists who aren't afraid to admit it.
I believe in courting. If I find a girl that I find attractive, I want to get to know her.
And girls ready to go steady.
I have yet to been asked out on a date. I don't know if it's something wrong with me or if it's just the culture of the school.
So for more on this hookup scene and how it's affecting America's youth, let's bring in Donna Freitas, the author of The End of Sex. I think of that boy in the middle of the piece, Donna, who says, you know, oh, well, maybe the next day, you know, maybe she'll get my number. Like, he's going to deign to give her his phone number after they've, you know, just spent the night together.
What's the goal here?
Well, I think especially the young men that I interviewed would talk about how that kind of bravado is expected, even if it's not something that's truly them, even if it's not what they want. And what they really want is to see that girl again.
So where do we go from here, you know? I mean, and how does this affect, or does it affect? Maybe it doesn't, you know, these kids' relationships going forward.
Well, one of the things that I think we really need to talk about as a culture is, what is the meaning of sex given hookup culture? Because we have to consider hookup culture when we're thinking about what is good sex or what do you want from sex? Because all of those, you know, you showed those words that students will use, regretful and empty and ashamed, you know, that 41% of students, you know, and how they respond hooking up. But there's another middle group, about 30% of students, who are really ambivalent. And I think that group is getting bigger because I think students are getting much better at hooking up, which means they're getting better at having ambivalent sex. So sex isn't about fun or even really about pleasure. It's about getting it done and being able to say that you did it.
That's the whole thing, just documenting, because we live in this media culture where it's like, you know, the numbers and just doing something just to say you did it or to take pictures of the event and then put it out there online so you can prove to everybody that you're having a great time.
And one of the things that I think is really interesting is students are, you know, they feel very proud of themselves now when they're getting better at hooking up, you know, when they're better at being able to walk away and say, you know what, I don't feel a thing. Like, I don't want to see that person again. It didn't really mean anything to me. And I think we need to be concerned about that, because I know that the young people I teach, if they're going to be sexually active, I would like them to be self-aware about it, and I would like them to be at least excited and having fun.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're not really is concerning.
Well, we talked to some kids, and we'll show this one tomorrow, who, you know, feel like they're happy that they're not involved in this culture, and then some kids who are. It's a fascinating look at what's going on here. Donna, thank you very much.
Thanks so
much. Good to have you with us. You bring up a very important point in this book.
All right.
Now for something a little bit different.
Okay. All right. And there you have it. All right. Let's get into some of the topics here. All right. So what is hookup culture? What is a hookup culture? We describe what is a hookup, but they're actually identifying it as a culture. What really is that? What's the difference between the activity and a culture?
I think it's a shift in the attitude, general attitude around relationship or unstructured relationships, I guess you could call them.
Okay. So, what's fundamentally the shift?
That there's a lack of concern or care around it, that it that young adults are engaging in casual sex in a way that is very different than people have in the past.
Okay, that's
or to a greater extent, I guess, without a real relationship.
Right. So this is so basically sex without relationships at all. So it used to be America was a strongly Christian nation. So people that, you know, sex outside of marriage was strongly and vigorously looked down upon, certainly through the 50s and even up to the mid-60s. Then you had the sexual revolution, and then sexuality became, you know, if it was part of a long-term relationship, you know, or it was more accepting to have sex outside of marriage. Leave it at that.
There seems to be much more of a perfect storm brewing now as technology facilitates. Isn't
correct.
It?
That's so the next.
It's not just an attitude shift.
Right.
The attitude shift occurred 50 years ago.
Right. Correct. But it took a couple of steps. Actually, the book, which I'm just going to quote a little snippet from, identified this another person, Lisa Wade. She studied it, her book, American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus. A different author, different researcher. She identified this actually. She traces the hookup culture coming from the gay community, because in the gay community, having you know, sort of like this anonymous sexual escapades was very prevalent, you know, until it's called AIDS, you know, where that was a very, very common phenomenon. That sort of, she wants to argue, it traveled over to the general population, A, and B, Mendel, what you're bringing up, of course, now, the fact that you have Tinder and Bumble and Fish in the Sea, et cetera, and J-Swipe, it has the same amount of energy you need to exert for, you know, ordering a book on Amazon Prime. How long does it take you to order something on Amazon Prime? 42 seconds, okay? And if you get the one click, it's 12 seconds. And you will be under increasing credit card debt if you allow that feature to be part of your Amazon profile. Anyways, so correct. Now, the woman in the clip there, what does she claim as a motivation? What is the claim? What is she saying? Is it not about? This is very interesting. And what is it about? This is the most very intriguing thing.
Can I take a shot at that?
Moshe Chaim Dodes, you got it, baby.
So she said it's not about sex, it's not about relationships, it's about status and sharing and being able to project this image of yourself.
Well, it is about sex because they're having sex.
But it's not about a relationship or closeness or intimacy.
Correct. So the features of sexuality, which you would think would be pleasure, and a relationship and intimacy and romance and all those features are not present, but rather it's essentially an activity of what? Well, you said status, but let's be a little more specific. What did she want to argue? So what's undergirding this whole thing?
Are you talking about from the interview we just watched?
Yeah, from the interview we just watched, that author.
Projecting an image.
Image of?
Yourself and how you think other people should see you.
Yeah, bravado and macho-ness on the part of the man, anyway.
Right. Right. So you have one factor is the that it's not so much the experience so much as the interest.
Of
conquest. Now the question is, what's the female part about that? What's the benefit for them?
I'm going to step up here and suggest something.
Please, Samantha.
I think it's very much it's like a thing of like who can care less, who cannot feel, kind of. There's definitely that element, and just kind of like a woman saying, "I can do whatever I want. I don't need to depend upon a man. Like I can just come and go, get what I need, and."
So on the female side, you're saying there's a satisfaction of, you know, absolute independence.
I think so. I think there's a degree of that.
Right. Also, I would assume, and I don't know, this is an interpretation, if everybody is participating, since it's now no longer an activity, but it goes to a culture, there has got to be a huge amount of pressure now. Because to go against the culture is difficult. So there's going to now, it creates sort of a self, people do not want to be alone. You don't want to be asocial. And if it's a feature of the socializing of that particular community, whether it be the campus or Manhattan, you know, the adult campus called Manhattan, right? So the bottom line is that that's the deal. So, all right. So, by the way, before we go further, who gets the worst end of the deal? The men or the women?
The women.
Why? By far, the women.
Why? Define that.
I think because women are naturally inclined to want to be in a relationship. Like, you know, we're always talking with Torah that, like, you know, like, a man and woman come together and, like, just, like, there's a sense of completion.
Right.
But also I was reading somewhere in Torah or, like, a commentary that was just saying, like, like, a woman then become, like, what was said about Eve, that not that she's, like, going to be a slave to Adam, but just that she's always going to be, like, wanting to be in a relationship?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Azer Connecto.
Well, Azer Connecto is the sort of the partnership dimension, but insofar as how the Torah describes sort of their three dimensions of Eve's quote-unquote punishment for participating in the fruit, you know, of giving of the fruit of the Eitz Hadas, one feature of that, one consequence of that crime was and he will dominate her. In other words, she will want, she will be needy of that. There will be a part of her that wants that relationship.
Right, like she'll always feel this, like, sadness. Because,
correct.
Like, won't be on the same...
A sense of incompleteness, a sense of loneliness, sort of an implicit existential loneliness.
Is there a sense of a certain element of vulnerability that is perpetually there in terms of the man and the male and female, not interaction, but not interaction between the two of them, but interaction with the world in general, the external world in general?
Right, that's a broader question about what does that whole episode of Adam and Chava mean, but I just want, that's a mega topic, but I will just, comment to agree with Samantha. Yeah, the position of the Torah in general is that, I think, which is, one could argue with maybe a psychological fact even, is that women tend to enjoy relations more, feel, want to be in relations more. Not that men don't, they do. And there's a sense of maybe more prone to a longing to be in a relationship, where a guy often will be not feeling that, per se. Okay. Now, what does she say? Now, this is very interesting. What was her quote-unquote solution? What does she want to have? What does she say, you know, what would be a rectification, in her mind, be a rectification of the situation?
People pursuing relationships that are satisfying and meet their needs and that aren't for a larger societal, culturally dictated purpose.
Right. In other words, which is now where people should now have sex for pleasure and for a relationship, and not just merely as you know, as a sort of you know, conquest activities, and that it should be noted and identified. And also, I found out in my research there is another app called Lulu. Does anybody know what that is? It's a women's only app, which you rate the men in your, you know, in your, people have, it's women only, and they check it via your Facebook profile, and they rate the men, you know, sort of like the Yelp for men. So it becomes like an absolute commoditization of men and female, you know. Anyways, let's...
So with this app, Lulu, is not about meeting other people or hooking up or anything?
It's sort of like, you know, like in Amazon, you have your consumer reviews. No, you don't want to, you know, if you want to buy that, you don't want to buy that, movie that nobody liked, and you don't want to date that guy that nobody liked, that felt was, that was a, that had all these deficiencies. So there's sort of a...
I definitely could have used that at some
point. Maybe after the class, you want to download that app for your, to your phone there. A little recommendation. Anyways, yeah, that's a Lashon Hara machine, you know. Go, you know, we discussed that last week, but can't get into that in this week. Anyways, all right, so let's read this little quote I got from the other book. Let's have Sean read it out.
All right, the fog of hookup culture, in other words, isn't just on college campuses. It's everywhere. It has infiltrated our lives, obscuring our ability to envision better alternatives, sexualities that are more authentic, kinder, safer, more pleasurable, and less warped by prejudice, consumerism, status, and superficiality. We need to understand what's happening on college campuses, because what's happening there is happening everywhere. By the author of American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus, by Lisa Wade.
Right, so Lisa Wade, in her research, is that this is not a phenomena which is only limited to the college campuses. It's absolutely everywhere. So, which gets me to my next question. What does culture do for promoting a family? Or a good family? Shayna?
The culture destroys it. Because it's not encouraging long-term relationships and the building of families. It's encouraging the one night.
Correct. Not even a night. Not even a whole night. Well, right. Maybe even less.
There's also an issue here of people not learning to deal with communication issues and pushback and dealing with rejection and other things that you get from the experience of building or other and attempting and failing to build relationships.
There you go.
Finally get one. What are you going to do with it? You're not going to be able to maintain it.
Right. Because it's the ultimate, the ultimate throwaway consumer experience. In other words, each person enjoys it for the short time and it's disposable. It has the same lasting life as the paper cup that you contained your Starbucks coffee in the morning. You drank from the cup of coffee, you enjoyed the cup of coffee, you threw out the cup. Done.
I think the lifespan of a gnat probably will give it stiff competition, but okay.
Exactly. All right. So with this introduction, I think without even bringing it up, I think in a certain sense, I sort of begin to share with you what the Torah, which was ironically radical in its perspective on sexuality when it was given, and to this very day is radical as well. It's counterculture as well. We've gone full circle. We're back to a sort of a pagan times in regards to sexuality. So here we go. So the Torah, this week's parsha, deals with these mitzvot. All right, let's take a look at it. All right, so let me have Adam Feit read. Take off you're still on mute.
There we go.
That's helpful.
I spoke to Moses telling him to speak to the Israelites and say to them, I am God. Do not follow the ways of Egypt where you once lived, nor of Canaan where I will be bringing you. Do not follow any of their customs. Follow my laws and be careful to keep my decrees, for I am God your Lord. Keep my decrees and laws, since it is only by keeping them that a person can truly live. I am God.
I stop right there. So the Torah in this week's Torah portion, chapter 18, gives us a sort of a general motif. What is the foundational principle of the laws of sexuality? What's the opening statement? The opening theme here. What is the foundational principle that animates the laws of sexual laws? Sean?
Basically, don't follow what Egypt did. So what happened in Egypt, don't do. That's one.
Right, so basically, the Jews who are immersed in Egyptian culture and they're going into Canaanite culture, basically, that culture was basically a culture which had full sexual promiscuity. In other words, there were very few sexual boundaries, as we're about to see, because they're going to list all the things that a Jew should not do. Okay? All right, so Sean, pick it up. 8:16.
Okay. Oh, I was going to say also, what I thought also interesting was 18:5, where the end of it says, well, by keeping them, then a person can truly live. So it's saying that your life is missing something if you don't follow these.
Correct. It's counterintuitive. A person imagines that if I have restriction in my life, I'm missing something. The Torah claims, which anybody who knows anything about any successful art or achievement, success comes through discipline. Success comes through discipline. And the Torah wants a person to have a disciplined life. And in this particular chapter, it's about a disciplined body. So therefore, every single craving a person might feel, even if they could access it, and nowadays, thank you, Tinder, we can access it, okay? Whether you're married or not married, you have access to all this. It's actually counterproductive. You're becoming an Egyptian. So let's see what the first thing they open up here. Go on. Which, by the way, the first thing that was common in Egypt. Go ahead.
All right. Incest. No person shall approach a close relative, she'er, to commit a sexual offense. I am God.
Okay. So number one. So if you ask somebody, what do you think about incest? Most people say, well, that's icky. That makes them feel uncomfortable. Well, apparently, it didn't make the Egyptians or the Canaanites feel too uncomfortable. Because the reason that Torah has to say one could not engage in incest is because there's a part of a person, if you would strip away, you know, some social boundaries, would be able to do this. Because if it was absolutely impossible, if it was something that a person does not feel whatsoever, the Torah would not have to forbid it. You know what I'm saying?
Is this that whole Oedipus complex?
The Oedipus complex has to be the attraction to the mother.
The Electra complex also, which is the daughter for the father.
Daughter for the father, son, mother, father, daughter, but also be siblings. But I'm not without ascribing to any particular psychological interpretation. Freudian or anyways, if you will Google after class incidents of incest in America, you will be shocked. Because I know that I was when I looked it up. It is not a small amount, and it's one of those crimes that are wildly underreported according to people who study this professionally. Okay? So even though people have a natural aversion and repulsion to it, it's just gone into the dark corners of our society, okay? So it's a reality, and the Torah says we don't. By the way, do you have to view it as being icky, or do you say this is, or you just have to say principally, this is not what I'm going to do? You don't have to have an ick response. You're supposed to have a philosophical principle response. This is not living. This is not living a redeemed life. To engage in this. Let's go on.
Rabbi, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Who would be the close relatives, and do they have to be blood, or could they be by marriage as well?
So incest, talking about the blood relations. He's going to go on further. It's going to be explained later on in the chapter.
Okay.
Like a father-stepdaughter, let's going to get into that also. All right, whatever. These are all part... The term this is called arayot, prohibited sexual relationships. People who are not allowed, who's forbidden to have sex? People who can't categorically get married. Like a father to a daughter, a mother to a son, brother, sister, father's daughter-in-law. Okay, we'll get into this. I'm not going to go through all of them. It's, you know, I can't, you know. We're just trying to get like an overview. Go on.
Okay. Do not commit a sexual offense against your father or mother. If a woman is your mother, you must not commit incest with her.
Okay, go on.
Excellent.
Hold on 1 second. Sorry about that.
Do not commit incest with your father's wife, since this is a sexual offense against your father.
Okay.
Next. Do not commit incest with your sister, even if she is the daughter of only your father or mother.
Like a half-sister.
Whether she is legitimate or illegitimate, you must not commit incest with her.
Okay.
Do not commit incest with your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter, since this is a sexual crime against yourself.
All right, so there's each one of these verses needs to be broken down and analyzed. Let's see. So you get the basic deal.
question?
Yeah, please.
Does most of these sound like they're talking to men and not to women? For example, like with the parents, it says if a woman is your mother, you must not commit incest with her. But then if you're talking to daughters, like, wouldn't you say if a man is your father, you must not commit incest with him?
Right. That's a good question. The narrator is talking to a man. Right? It says, do not take a marry a woman, then take her sister. Okay. That's a good question. But from the oral law, the laws are equal. A woman can be involved in incest, and both parties are prohibited. In other words, they can't be involved in an incestual relationship. Let's do the 1820 here. I just want to do the last one because we're low on time.
I can't see it.
Do not lie carnally. This one?
Oh, that one. Okay. Do not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife, since this will defile her.
Okay. All right. So basically that's the prohibition of adultery. Okay. So now, one second. Okay. Now, number one. What were the ways of Egypt and Canaan? First of all these relations, it's incest. I didn't read the one that's also bestiality. It also is adultery. It's every sexual possibility you can imagine, and a few more you can't. Okay, that's number one. Two, in addition to that, the people of Egypt and Canaan, for example, this is going to be in Canaan. They would have, according to the oral tradition, an Egyptian way was number one, a woman. A man and two men getting married. In other words, gay marriage. So it's not just simply they're having a homosexual relationship. They're actually getting married. Or a woman marries two men. Or lesbians. Okay? That's under the Egyptian. That's according to the oral law. That was the way of the Egyptian. Those three examples. Okay? So you think that, you know, gay marriage is now allowed in America. It's a new thing. It's not a new thing. It's a very, very old thing. You know, so having homosexual relations sanctioned by the state goes back to the time of the Jews leaving Egypt. Okay, you know, so it's actually a very old thing. Now, so it's interesting. The Torah says, the first sentence over here, person should not approach a close relative to commit. Lo tikravu. Now, what does that mean? You can learn it two ways. What does approach mean? Why is that language used? You shouldn't approach them. It's really a double entendre. It has actually two meanings. What are the two meanings? Anyone want to take a hazard a guess?
One, like physically approach them, get close to them.
Well, it could be a euphemism for actual sexual intercourse, A, absolute closeness, A.
There should also be boundaries that you shouldn't even stray into the area where you're even getting close to sex.
Exactly. Michael Moshe Chaim Dodd, if that's the money answer. All right. So, let's take a look at the Rambam here. This goes to the laws of forbidden sexual relations. All right, Moshe Chaim Dodd, you got that good answer? You got to read the Rambam.
Cool. Chapter 21, Halacha 1. Whoever shares physical intimacy with one of the arayot without actually becoming involved in sexual relations or embraces and kisses one of them out of desire and derives pleasure from the physical contact should be lashed according to law. This is derived from Leviticus, which states to refrain from or perform any of these abominable practices, and also states do not draw close to reveal nakedness. Implies that we are forbidden to draw close to acts that lead to revealing nakedness.
Uh-huh. So here's a key point. This is sort of, here's basically the key point. The Torah recognizes that biologically, as you all noticed, people can't just instantaneously have sex. It doesn't work that way. There has to be, sex is a process. Now, it could be sped up, but really it's a process. One step of the process is a state where There's a rapport built, and there is mutual sexual interest is communicated. Okay? We call that flirting. Right? Second step is that people are alone where they could have sex. Step three is they're getting the people's in a psychological state where sex is ripe to occur. That's called foreplay. That, the Ram says, if a person is, you know, we call in the American vernacular, making out, which is making people in a state where sex could occur, doesn't have to, and they're enjoying it, that is a Torah violation. Why? Because it says, as Moshe Chaim pointed out, you can't even approach to get to that state. So even the approach to the sexual act is immediately forbidden, even if it doesn't even eventuate in that. Okay? If people make out for 20 minutes and they don't have sex, you know, again, we're talking about Jews who are not married to each other, then that would be prohibited. Okay?
Was this the reason for Yehud and Shomer?
Oh, we're going to get there. Oh, yes. So that is what they call, when people say you're Shomer Negia, it doesn't mean, Negia means touching, Shomer means I'm guarding from touching. It doesn't mean technically, you know, touching, like tapping the person on the shoulder so they can walk in the other direction. It means a contact which is sexual. Now, many people don't even shake a woman's hand because as sort of a, you know, sort of a boundary. But the technical, the real being shomer negia means you don't express physical affection to somebody of the other, you know, the other gender, which basically means kissing, hugging, making out. Okay?
I just like to point out that there are no more genders, so...
Okay, the opposite gender, whatever the person's gender, whatever gender they think they are, whatever that whole thing is. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mendel, for elevating the conversation. Appreciate that.
Actually, I can corroborate that.
Okay, good. We had to bring in, you know, we needed to have at least one trans joke or else we could not fulfill our obligation of tonight's Parsha class. Let's keep on going. We're on a roll. All right. Halacha, now I go to halacha number, chapter 22, halacha number 1. Go ahead. Moshe Chaim.
It is forbidden to enter into privacy with any of the women forbidden as arayot, even if she's elderly or a young girl, for this leads to forbidden relations. The only exceptions are a woman and her son, a father and his daughter, and a husband with his wife who is in the nida state.
Okay, so here's interesting. So the Torah, now by the way, this actually, I could have gone another direction, because we all know that our vice president, Mike Pence, what's his rule? You guys all heard it, unless you're living in a cave. What's his rule? What's that?
He won't be alone with anyone other than his wife, and he won't drink alcohol unless his wife is there.
Correct. So I said, well, obviously he's following the Rambam's chapter 22, halacha number 1. This is for us. Is not a, a Christian value. This is a Torah value going back in time. So whoever you're not allowed, a rayot means, as we said in that list from chapter 18, anybody who categorically you cannot marry, okay? Whether it be incest, whether it be adultery, whether it be any kind of forbidden marriage, you're not allowed to be alone with them, okay? Or you can't be alone in the office. You can't be alone in a hotel room. You can't be alone in a remote area. You can't go on a hike with them. You can't go in an environment where privacy means where the person will feel comfortable having sex.
Can I offer one thing here?
Yeah.
My rabbi actually did speak about the Mike Pence thing when it came up, and the one concern I raised with him was that you can't disadvantage women in the workplace by refusing to meet with them privately because of that, that there are ways around that. So
Mike Pence needs to learn some of the totality of the chapter, because the definition of alone means alone. So if the door is ajar, right, and people could walk in, they're not defined as alone. So you could meet with a young intern if you leave the door ajar.
Yeah, just wanted to bring that in, that this is not to completely put down women in other situations.
No, God forbid. God forbid. It's just that the Torah recognizes one reality, And this is the reality I want to share with you tonight. I think all of you, and at least myself, were shocked about the level of Tinder uses, right? So if you're talking 26 million mutual matches per day, now, let's say not all of them are successful. We're talking about levels of sexual promiscuousness of a, you know, of an unbelievable amount. Now, it could be there are obviously, it's not universal. I'm sure there are more heavy users than others. I'm sure the distribution curve is, you know, not equal, but it's immense. The key point here is like this. The terror of you is like this. A person has a sexual drive. A person does not know the nature of the extent, dimension, features of that sexual drive. It is largely unconscious to us. So therefore, what is the terrorist strategy of not being defeated by the person's sexual life and living a disciplined life? What is the fundamental strategy?
Protect yourself from temptation.
By?
Don't put yourself in that situation.
Exactly. Avoiding situations where the inevitable will occur. I'll give you a good example. In the world of addiction therapy, people who deal with people who have addiction, heroin, alcohol, even sex could be an addiction. What they define is that a person could be perceived as being in two states, a cold state and a hot state. The cold state is when the person is involved in something else, completely disinterested in that activity. Theoretically, you're having this class right now. If you're an alcoholic, you're not going to necessarily be thinking about alcohol and getting drunk. But if a person is an alcoholic and they walk into the bar and they sit in their favorite booth and three of their friends climb into the booth with them and they start to order, you know, the drinks of the night, it's going to be very hard to turn the ship around. So basically, Tara recognized that person has to be honest. I don't know the extent of my sexuality. So therefore, categorically, there are certain activities I'm not going to be involved in because there's a point when a person's in a hot state, they can't turn around. Okay? So therefore, the prohibition of what we call yichud is that I can't even be alone. Now notice, I don't know if you caught this, he says, even if she's elderly or a young girl, what does that mean?
Can't be alone with your grandmother or your...
No, grandmother you could be.
Really?
You would think that people don't have generally, in the mainstream, these are not people that you would think you're attracted to.
Yeah, you probably are not. But the thing is that, first of all, there's two aspects. The Torah has to deal with what? Categorically. And the truth is that there will be a small percentage that this may even pose a problem. And you don't know to the extent that you don't know what your issues are or what your unconscious is. So any women who you can't be with, you're not allowed to be alone with. Simple as that. Except for your... Now, I didn't quote the halacha. Is that brother... Interesting. I'll give you a share another halacha. Classic situation. Brother and sister. What do you say? Can they be alone in the room?
Yes.
No.
They can be. They just can't be there for a... they actually view that as being the middle category. I didn't bring that halacha down. Is the brother and sister can't be alone for a prolonged amount of time. So what's that defined as? Like 30 days. So the classic situation, the Upper West Side. Upper West Side, rents are very expensive. So, boy, brother and sister, you know we're going to solve the problem. We are going to get an apartment together. Boom. That's yichud. That's yichud. Even when a person says, oh, that's disgusting, it's gross, never going to happen. You, even though it might be true by you, the Torah says that wall is not as ironclad as you think it is. Okay, let's go on. All right, let's go another one. So halacha number two and three. Go ahead.
The prohibition against entering into privacy with women forbidden as arayot has been transmitted by the oral tradition.
Right. This is a statement of the Ram. It's not clear. Does he mean it's a biblical violation or a rabbinic violation? Okay, it's one of those not clear. There's a debate what the Ram means. Is it a biblical violation or a rabbinic violation? All right, let's go on.
Halacha 3, when the incident concerning Amon and Tamar occurred, David and his court decreed a prohibition against entering into privacy with an unmarried woman. Although an unmarried woman is not an erva, such an act is considered as entering into privacy with an erva. Shammai and Hillel decreed a prohibition against entering into privacy with Gentiles.
Okay, so two single people theoretically can be, they're not an erva, they could get married to each other. But there was an incident, Amnon and Tamar. Amnon was Tamar's half-brother. You know, she was his half-sister. David, King David, was their father. If you read the story in Tanakh, she raped him. He raped her. Amnon raped Tamar. So, according to the oral tradition, they made a privacy that unmarried people can't be alone as well. Okay? And they add on that Jews and non-Jews, you know, male Jews cannot be alone with female non-Jews. And female Jews can't be alone with with non-Jewish men. That's a rabbinic addition. Okay, so here's the key. Here's the takeaway. I'm going to put it all into sort of a closing statement. We opened up our conversation exploring the reality of the hookup culture and the reality of what it's doing to a desensitizing to sexuality, to make it a impersonal, unemotional, separate from any kind of relationship, and certainly responsibility and marriage. The Torah takes the opposite view. The goal of sexuality is to have a meaningful marriage. Therefore, all things which are not instrumental to that are forbidden. Two is that sexuality is a very unclear, mysterious force in man. A person does not know what's going to turn them on, how it's going to turn them on, when is it going to turn them on. It's a weird thing. You'll never get to the bottom of that. So the Torah has a very simple strategy. To live a disciplined life, to have a disciplined body, to have a disciplined mind, you need to assume an act of humility and say, if I'm going to be in a situation, I'm not likely to be able to control myself, so therefore I cannot make out with a girl who I'm not married with and assume that I'm not going to have sex with them. The assumption is, I will. Therefore, the Torah forbade even that state. Not only that, the Torah says, not only that, you can't be alone in a room where you could have it, even if you're not interested in the girl. It doesn't go in. It doesn't make a difference. Jewish law goes by categorically. Anybody you can't be married to, except for your mom or your dad, or by extension, grandparents. You're not allowed to be alone with them because ultimately your will ultimately get woven, you know, get knocked down. You'll get weak and you'll have a problem. So that's a terrorist strategy for sexuality. So here's the wild irony of things. The Torah came in the world 3,300 years ago with a counterculture approach to sexuality. The cultures where the Jews were, Egypt, and where they're going, Canaan, were sexually open communities and societies just like America is today, probably even more, because America still has a little bit of Christian value still left, a little bit left. So, again, we find ourselves, if a person is observant of Jewish law, if they keep kashrut, if they keep Shabbat, and they're keeping in the sexual laws, they find themselves, again, being a counterculture personality because our values are different. Sexuality is there to support and add meaning and value to a loving, mutual satisfying marriage. That's the goal of sexuality, not to have sexuality which is for entertainment or for superficiality or for status or any of the other strange reasons that the hookup culture is promoting, either directly or indirectly. And that's what that's the sort of like a basic 101 about sexuality in Judaism. I mean, one consequence that we suffer from, I'm talking about all of us in Manhattan, is that because of the sexual revolution and exacerbated by the hookup culture, people push off marriage till deep into their 30s. And then they wake up, I want to get married. And all kinds of problems occur. A, you know, marriage and raising and then kids, it helps being younger. Kids are exhausting. I'm 50 years old. You know what I mean? I have younger kids. It's very exhausting. It's something that when you're like in your 20s or your early 30s, you got the energy for. That's the A. B is there's the issue of fertility. A woman does not remain fertile for eternally. After 35, there are issues of fertility. Many women that I know who get married later struggle with, and the couple struggles with, fertility issues. So delaying a marriage is a disaster. I'm not saying get married at 14, but getting married in the 30s has been, our culture has pushed this, and it's there are a lot of nasty consequences that have to be dealt with. So I think the argument is that on one hand, people find on the surface Jewish sexuality as being repressive. I argue Jewish sexuality is really the key to freedom. It's literally counterintuitive. That was what I wanted to present tonight. Any questions? It's a big topic, big area. Any questions at all?
Well, to add, that halakhic theory, the implication of that is also against the cohabitation before marriage that's so prominent.
Yes, correct. It goes without saying that until people are married, they cannot have the terrorists against having sex before marriage. Again, because there can't be, this gets into another dimension, which I touch upon, is that the terror, one idea of why the terrorist says you can't have sex before marriage, because the nature of a man, and even to extent to a woman, but more so a man, is to shirk responsibility. And as one of my former students said to me, Rabbi, if I'm getting the milk, why do I need to buy the cow? I said, thanks. Thanks for sharing that. But the bottom line was, what he's saying was, the fact that he was sexually active, shall we say, slowed down his motivation to get married. And that was a problem because it basically promotes being in an eternal adolescent state, never growing up.
Yeah, it's a problem for us too. That's what happens when you get set up with like 50-year-old men by accident.
Oops.
isn't there a prohibition against having wine with Gentiles as well, or alcohol?
In a bar. I mean, it's a little bit. That's a whole other topic. But
isn't that connected to this, though?
Yeah, a person. I mean, without going through the technical Jewish halacha about that, but going out to a bar with a non-Jew can be problematic. There are certain situations where it could be technically worked through, but in general it's a bad idea. Because if you're drinking with him, you know, you might end up sleeping with him.
Do you see, I'm not familiar with J-Swipe at all, but do you see that as pretty much the Jewish equivalent or
Yeah, it's what it is. It's what it is. What?
You're doing it with Jews instead.
All right, that's I would argue that's a level of kedusha.
But
it's a step in the right direction. If a person is only having relationships with Jews, that's a level better than with everybody.
Better than non-Jews.
Yes.
Do you see Jewish culture in Manhattan or around the world or wherever in general, contemporary Jewish culture as thoroughly involved in the hookup culture as well?
You know, I, they don't stop by my office to bring me up to date, but I know what's going on. I mean, if people who are non-Orthodox, let's put it in the non-Orthodox community, the barrier of no sex before marriage is gone. Just like it's no different than it is the American society, by and large, maybe slightly less. And in the Orthodox community, it's fraying around the edges.
Okay.
And especially as people get older, where it becomes harder to, you know, remain, you know, not having sex. It's not a natural state to be in as well. So, person has a sexual drive that has to be addressed. The Torah is not designed for people to, you know, be, you know, older and not having sex. I'm not saying you should get married for sex, but that's an important element of the relationship. It's an important element of the relationship. So it's not an easy situation. Not an easy situation.
I mean, is there anybody in the class who's under 30? Just curious. No, everybody in the class is over 30. Okay. Is there anybody in the class who's over 40 and not married right now?
Not in this class, no.
Okay. So everybody in the class is 30. There's, I think, 9 participants. I know Rabbi's married. So there's 8
Also, Danielle's married also, and so is Michael Doves.
Yep. So there's 6 people in the class who are not married right now, between 30 and 40.
Okay. And your point is what there, Mendel?
I'm just trying to get a demographic, just general demographics.
That's the world we're in.
Take the shit off.
That's it. So that's the bottom line. So I'm just, you know, I think it's... The takeaway
goes back to some things you mentioned earlier about, you know, trying to get married when you're over 30.
Let me just end on a positive note. Let's end on a positive note here. The bottom line is that a person who observes these laws automatically is in a better situation because. One of the elements that, I don't know, if going back to the earlier mentioning of the hookup, there's one thing that is absent from the hookup culture. It really is happiness. Yes, people are having sex, but it's a sexuality which is devoid of any kind of content. It's superficial. It's fleeting. There's a sort of a 45% add the word regret and ashamed. You know what I mean? They're not feeling great about it. And there's another chunk or another 30% who are ambivalent. You know, they feel mixed feelings about it. So up to 75% of the people, the vast majority of people who are involved in it, when they're not in the hot state of the situation, are not happy. So here, the Torah, if you observe these laws, the Torah is giving you a automatic level of high quality of life just on that thing alone. They think they're running after an illusion. They think by having the, you know, swiping to the right, hooking up with a girl or hooking up with a guy, having a very superficial relationship is going to make them feel better. It's not. So by withdrawing from that, you're automatically a happier person. I will end the class with that. And, you know, there are a lot of questions. The goal is here just to open the door to the topic. The topic is a vast topic. There's more philosophical points to talk about. There are more halachic points to talk about. There's a wealth of material on that. But again, I just wanted to, you know, spend an hour with you guys and just give you some of the main points.
Thank you, Rabbi.
All right, guys. Have a good night.
Are you teaching on Wednesday or not?
I'm teaching tomorrow.
You're teaching tomorrow. Okay, good.
All right, guys. Be well.